The Vienna Game, written by Paratactician, read by Code Switch. Chapter 12, Carnival. The clown cultist didn't speak, just led Salix on a threading path between slopes of candy-striped canvas that bellied and shuddered in the night wind. The grass was muddy and churned up, as though by hundreds of feet before them. Every so often, Salix had to step over a straining guy rope or a metal peg jutting up from the ground. He was glad of the coat. It was cold here. The stories had been exaggerated. There were no rotting corpses held aloft in webs of tangled bunting, no heads on spikes, no creepy barkers with their mouths sewn shut, hawking cotton candy studded with fresh eyeballs. It just looked like a rundown funfair. Somehow, that made it worse. The booths and stalls stood dark and empty. One had collapsed in on itself. There was nothing to be seen in the tents they passed but blackness. A dilapidated merry-go-round, its muscle beasts stalled at intervals, still bright with garish paint and silly expressions. A deserted coconut shy, one coconut smugly intact on its post. Here and there, on an expanse of canvas or the back of a booth, someone had daubed a symbol in sticky purplish paint, a rough smiley face, two small circles for eyes, a bigger one for the nose, and a long slashed curve for a mouth. The stars overhead were ice white and pitilessly sharp. As they picked their way along the edge of another marquee, he said, "You were him, weren't you? The guy on the street, outside Tinkerbell's." "If you up and motherfuckin' say so, brother," said the clown, and turned his head to favor Salix with a wide and unsettling smile. "Don't jerk me around, man. How did you know? How long have you even been after me?" "You get your think on for a second," said the clown, this time without looking round. "You think on back some. You picture that righteous motherfucker all up in the street there, no sense even as to wear a coat in the motherfucking rain." He stepped over a rope without breaking stride. "You picture any motherfucking shadow round about his gangly ass, little hacker?" Salix blinked and thought. The concrete slick with rain, ripples swimming argan orange and puddles of black glass, and the cultist's arms spread wide in benediction. "Son of a bitch," he said. The clown made a kind of clucking, tutting noise. "Shouldn't do drugs, brother. Rust up your motherfucking pan. Have you clean, seeing all sorts of freaky shit as ain't there." "How long?" Salix demanded. "How fucking long have you been in my brain?" "Mustard pot," said the clown. "You ever hear a motherfucker give and say how is talking to your own motherfucking self's the first sign of madness?" "Yeah." The shaggy snarl of hair shook left, right, left, although the head still didn't turn. "Talking to your own self ain't no motherfucking sign of madness. First sign of motherfucking madness is when your own self starts up on talking back." Before Salix could think of a smart answer to this, the clown suddenly and without warning swung left beneath a pinned back flap of canvas in the side of a tent they were circumnavigating. He followed, ducking his head so his horns didn't catch on the fabric. The interior of this tent, unlike the others he'd glimpsed, was warm and well lit, and smelt strongly of the sawdust covering the wooden boards that made up the floor. There was almost no furniture. The light came from a Baroque crystal chandelier, improbably hung by a chain from the very apex of the conical roof, where the narrowing red and white stripes finally converged. It looked like it belonged in Villa Empora, not a circus tent. Directly beneath the chandelier was a chair set on stilt legs, so that its seat was fully 6 feet off the floor. Its occupant was a slightly built individual wearing a perfect white tailcoat over an acid green shirt that reminded Salix of the candies he'd eaten with Terezi on the tunnel platform. His breeches and boots were spotless white, one knee crossed lazily over the other, and instead of a head, he had a smooth and entirely featureless white sphere. One gloved hand trailed down over the side of the chair, holding what looked like a bright green length of rope. After a moment's confusion, Salix realized it was a horsewhip. He didn't have much time to spend on the ringmaster, though. 4 metal cages, each cylindrical and taller than a troll, stood around the chair, 2 in front, 2 behind, like towers. 3 were apparently empty. The 4th, in front of the chair, to Salix's left, held a young woman in a long black dress, tied at the waist with a purple sash. Her hands gripped the bars of the cage, and her hair was so pale it was almost white. She saw him, and her eyes widened slightly, but she didn't move. "Ah, Mr. Captor," said the ringmaster. He had no mouth, but the voice was clear and cool and precise, neat vowels and consonants bitten cleanly off. "Good evening. Thank you for joining us. My name is Scratch." Salix glanced up at him, then back to Rose. "Nice suit. What are you? Security, autonomic, AI?" "Something rather more sophisticated than either," said Scratch. "But yes, if it helps, you may think of me as an exceptionally complex artificial intelligence. It's a term that I dislike. What makes one intelligence more artificial than another? But these labels do stick, alas." "Yeah, I've got a few other things you can stick," said Salix. "Get my friend out of that cage, or the circus is leaving town in a big fucking way." "Your loyalty does you credit. The last time you met our Ms. Lalonde, she sold your brain to a hungry god. I thought you might be at least a little piqued." Scratch shifted in his chair. "Tell me, have you been introduced to Mr. Makara?" Salix turned. The clown cultist, who was still standing at his right elbow, turned too and stuck out a long-fingered hand, claws ragged and stained at the tips. Salix ignored it and said, "Makara?" The clown tilted his head to the side in acknowledgement. "That's the name." "No way," said Salix. "No fucking way. Gamzee Makara? You're the guy from the story, the one who found the carnival. You're dead." "Too motherfucking right," said the clown affably. "This is one dead-ass motherfucker you're up and getting your gossip on with." "This is horseshit," said Salix, but he knew it wasn't. The clown's code patterns had been baffling him all the time they'd been picking their way between the tents. He had the signature of an organic, none of the clean lines of a program, even an AI, but the distinctive jumble of a meatspace user. Yet there was no sign of a hard link, no magic thread trailing back along the fibers of the medium to an interface or a gateway. Either a program had been very, very skillfully disguised to look like an organic, complete with all the redundancies and inefficiencies, or an organic had somehow been cut loose to operate as a program. The former seemed sort of pointless. The latter was meant to be impossible. But there was no wind in the medium, either. "I assure you," said Scratch, "my associate is no longer alive. He has, biologically speaking, ceased to be. He is an ex-Makara." Gamzee smiled. Salix shook himself. He was clearly meant to ask, "What? How?" And he wasn't going to give anyone in this freak show that satisfaction. "Listen," he said, facing Scratch again. "I love what you've done with the place, but I promised I'd finish a job, and I'm going to finish it no matter how many dead girlfriends and fucked up glitch loops and asshole clowns you throw at me, so can we cut the shit here, get Rose out of the cage, and get the fuck out of my way, or I'm going through you. Clock's running." He was surprised to find it wasn't just bravado. There was an anger boiling in him now he hadn't felt since before the crash. Not the weary contempt on which he'd strung his nights of exile, the shambling, dumb resentment that had filled his pan like static, a clouded haze of cheap beer in green glass bottles, and red pills popped from plastic blisters, and shot glasses brimming with clear liquid, trash spilt in damp black alleys, and the sour tang of vomit in his nose. Seeing Aradia, dead and solemn and alone, had shaken something free, a memory of rage, at least. It was an old rage, quick and fierce, and he hugged it to him like hot coffee on a winter morning. All of this was code, and he broke code. Scratch made an elegant gesture with the hand that wasn't holding the whip. "Ah, yes, unforgivably remiss of me. Mr. Makara is dead, and I was never alive, but you, Mr. Captor, are dying, and I understand it accentuates the short term somewhat." Then he leant forward a little. No dramatic movement, just a slight hunching of the narrow shoulders. The chair creaked. "How would you like to stop dying?" Selleck stared at him. "I got the impression everyone stops dying in the end," he said. "Droll," said Scratch, "but not what I had in mind. No, I am talking about not life exactly, but something better. Afterlife, perhaps." "I cannot spare a fucking moment to talk about the sufferer," said Selleck levelly. The tone of voice suggested Scratch would have wrinkled his nose if he'd had one to wrinkle. "Oh dear, no, nothing so provincial. I'm not here to foist any pamphlets on you, Mr. Captor. I have too much respect for your intelligence, which is, in fact, rather the point." He sat back again. "I have a very simple offer to make. Will you hear me out? Your acceptance is in no way presupposed." "You've got 30 seconds. After that, Nelly the Tusk Beast's packing her hydrostatically prehensile proboscis." "I have never understood why that particular ditty re-emerged in Alternian," said Scratch thoughtfully. "The joke doesn't work anymore. Ah well. The offer is this. Regardless of your success or failure in retrieving the air and propagating regime change..." "Oh, don't look like that. You personally are in a great deal of trouble. Your body is, if you'll forgive my bluntness, collapsing. You have already entered metabolic shutdown and interparenchymal hemorrhage, and total cardiopulmonary arrest is but a few tottering steps away. I don't need to be a seer." He twitched the free hand towards Rose, who kept very still, staring at Selleck through the bars, "to see that your future is not a healthy one." "Yeah, I know," said Selleck, although hearing it laid out so clinically in that clipped, relentless voice made his hands shake a little at his sides. He jammed them in his pockets so Scratch wouldn't notice. "Knew that when I buzzed in." "You know it," Scratch replied. "But as so often, Mr. Captor, I don't believe you've understood it. All rational minds shrink from death. Your intelligence does not exempt you. You have come this far on adrenaline and terror and ambition precisely because you dare not turn and confront the darkness at your heels. You will die and be dead. There will be nothing left of you. Or perhaps you'll survive. Comatose, vegetative, floating on for 100 nights in a stasis cocoon before the decision is made to turn you off. If you're lucky, paralysis only from the neck down. I'm sure that someone will wheel you out into the garden now and then so you can listen to the birds singing." "Fucking fantastic," said Selleck tightly. "Why don't you tell me some more shit about how fast I'm turning into slurry? Really helps me relax and pay attention." Scratch spread his arms. The whip had vanished somehow. The point must have been made. "Death need not be the end, Selleck. I can set you free." Makara's head bowed in assent. "You best be getting your motherfucking listen on, brother," he said sternly. "Some wicked holy truths all be getting spoken here tonight." "On the third day he rose again in accordance with the scriptures," said Scratch. "Poor Gamzee died finding his way back to me, and now his faith has been rewarded, for he lives on in my surface. This is the carnival, my friend. We have no need for flesh." "Hold the fucking phone. You're saying you can, what, store my consciousness somehow? Back up the data? That's impossible." "To Alternian technology, absolutely," Scratch agreed. "I am not Alternian technology. I am far older than your empire, and far wiser, too. It would be the work of a moment to snip the thread that tethers your scintillating mind, with all its youth and force and grand ideas, to a leaking heap of meat for which you never expressed much fondness." He leant forwards again. "You could be free, Selleck. Free as you've always wanted. Free to soar on shining wings above the infinite canals and palaces of knowledge. A universe of data, and no walls to hold you back. A mind of such power and dexterity is too rare a thing to waste on death. you should live and sit at my right hand, as the sinister Mr. Makara does at my left." Selix hesitated. He remembered how it had felt when he'd first tried the honey, and buzzed back in after Perigee's, in that weird half-finished loft with the muzzle of Kanaya's slicer 10 prickling feet from his spine. He'd remembered the atomic fire that had surged along his limbs, and the sense of depth, of dimension snapping back into place around him. Before the crash, he'd sometimes wondered if sea dwellers felt the same way when they hit water, when their gill slits flexed and their vision sharpened, and they could move any way they wanted, not just back and forward, left and right. That time in the loft, he'd known it for a fact. It had been like being able to breathe again. "While we have the body and our soul is corrupted with its poison, we can never truly gain what we desire, which is, we claim, the truth," said Scratch, as if reading his mind, which was, in fact, pretty likely. "For the body burdens us with 1,000 duties by reason of its need to be maintained, and furthermore, if disease strikes us, it delays us in our quest for the truth. And the body fills us with affections and desires and fears and all sorts of fancies and endless nonsense, so that, as they say, we really and truly cannot think about anything at all. And all wars and revolutions and battles spring from the body and its desires, nothing else. It is the pursuit of money that causes conflict, and it is the body that compels us to seek money, since we are slaves in its service. So, in fact, we see clearly that, if we want to attain pure knowledge, we must be free from the body and must look with the soul alone. That's Plato, which, in your case, you have not got." "And I'd be, what?" Selix said, trying to sound like it was a neat idea, but he could see some flaws. "Your servant or something?" Scratch inclined his strange white head. "Or something. A little more than a servant, though a little less than an equal. An agent, perhaps? Or an angel, if you like. I hung 9 nights on the world ash, Mr. Captor. Mine is the kingdom, the power, and the glory. Patient, watchful Gamzee is my memory, but you, with your speed and your fire, you would be my thought." He said, "I've got a friend back in Meatspace. I said I'd get back to her." "No," said Scratch kindly. "You didn't. She said she'd get back to you. You very carefully avoided saying any such thing, because you were perfectly aware that on the slim chance that you survived immersion in the Imperial Network, you would emerge with the physical and mental faculties of a baked potato. A lie of omission, but a merciful one, I think." Thinking of Terezi reminded him, and he felt a jolt of self-loathing at being too wrapped up in Scratch's panorama to think of it before. "What about everyone else?" he said. "I'm not saying I buy this, but say I did. You break the link, I stay here in the medium. What happens to my friends?" Scratch paused, apparently considering this. Then he said, "I assume Miss Parope is your primary concern." "Yeah." "She is doing rather well, as a matter of fact. I have an eye on her. She encountered some difficulties with a Strider unit, but, through a combination of martial prowess and sheer determination, appears to have vanquished it. I doubt any other aspect of palace security will give her much trouble after that." Selix didn't bother hiding the grin. "Hell yes," he said. "What about Vantus and Lejon?" "Untroubled. And they will remain so. No one has to die here, Selix. Your friends will be allowed to leave the palace unmolested. The formidable Ms. Parope will, in all probability, be offered a job. I have no interest in amassing a body count, and nor, once the threat to her crown is past, will the Empress." He bit his lip and said, "Okay, here's the deal. You let me do my job and free the heir. After that, I'm all yours. You can turn me into an angel or use me to defrag your hard drive or whatever the fuck you want. I won't care anymore." "Ah, no, that won't do," said Scratch, in a delicately modulated tone of polite regret. "I'm sorry, sir, he's in a meeting." "The heir must stay. It is vitally important that her imperious condescension should retain the Alternian throne for another few sweeps at least. You don't see the big picture yet, but you will. And Rose? Said Salix, knowing the answer. She still hadn't taken her eyes off him. The seer belongs with me, as indeed does the witch, and even the knight, recalcitrant and troublesome drain on my time as he has always been. They are programmed, Mr. Captor, and in a very real sense, they are my property. I mean them no harm. They are all very precious to me. But I cannot permit them to pass, as it were, onto the open market. You understand the value of proprietary software. Yeah, I like the cages. Nice and subtle, he said. So I wipe the mission, join your team, and everyone lives, or I give you the finger, my brain pours out my ears, and everyone else takes their chances. Succinct and accurate, said Scratch, sounding a little amused. To my mind, it hardly seems a choice, but I leave the decision to you. He ran the tape. Tinkerbulls and the scarred chrome corner table, Tav Nitrum polishing a glass, Circuit and Kanaya, Feffery Pikesies, with her earnest intensity and her fucking dreadful Moiraille, Equia Zahak, flung back in his own blue blood with his dead eyes locked on nothing, the killer cat girl and the low-blood prophet stuck at the top of a feral stem in a room full of scented candles, Aradia's hair full of rain and her hands on the cards, and the look on her face as he'd stepped away, neither happy nor sad, just watching. Aradia telling him she liked his jacket. Terezi Parope. The tiny, grinning Legis Lacerator who'd saved his life twice already. She'd made him a sandwich and bought him a beer and killed at least 12 people on a casual count. She was sharp and fierce and probably smarter than him, and she had mirrors where her eyes should be, and in the stale semi-darkness of the skep, she'd put her hands on his shoulders and squeezed. He felt hard thumbs pushing and probing at the worst of the knots, and then her arms had slipped round him, and she'd held him tight, her skin slick as his, but a blessed step cooler, and pressed dry lips to the ridge of his C7 vertebra. "Yeah," he said. "Look, give me one thing, okay? Let me talk to Rose." Gamzee shifted at his elbow. Scratch's voice remained bland and colorless. "In private?" "Nah, right here. I just want to see if she's okay." "By all means, then, although I would advise you to be brief. You are, as you so vividly put it, turning into slurry." Selix took his hands out of his jeans pockets and moved towards the left-hand cage. Rose watched him come closer, her face nearly as closed off and unreadable as Scratch's blank white sphere. When he'd got within 6 feet, he stopped. Her black dress was almost floor length, very plain, with a high neckline, and the ragged hem didn't look like a fashion statement. It was chewed and frayed, individual wisps of thread trailing. Her pointless stubby claws were the same glossy purple as they'd been in his dreams, and her mouth was the same color, too, and he probably shouldn't be looking at her mouth. "Hey," he said. "Hey," she replied. He gave it a couple of seconds, just to flip off Scratch. Then he said, "I'm assuming you're not going to tell me, no, Salix, don't do it." "I can't," she said. "Everything he has told you has been absolutely correct. He isn't trying to mislead you, and he never lies." Was there something, some tiny urgency in the line of her jaw, a twitch behind the calm violet gaze?
"Even the part about you being his property?"
"Even that part."
"Yeah," he said. "I thought so."
"I really am sorry," she said quietly. This caught him off guard.
"What for?"
"For the culprit, the furthest ring. There was a snare laid in your brain, and I pushed you headlong into it."
"Oh, fuck, that was ages ago," he said, and reached into his back pocket. "Forget about it. Hey, you're not a real girl, right?"
The corner of her mouth twisted in what might have been a smile, and she said, No, I'm afraid I am not a real girl. Some would argue I never was."
"Does that mean you don't like flowers?" he said, withdrawing the hand and holding it out. It sat cupped in his palm, a perfect rose, black as ink, layered petals swirling outwards from a tightly bunched center. He felt a quick thrill of pride, despite everything. She stared at it, but before she could answer, he crouched down and brushed some sawdust away from in front of his feet to expose a narrow gap between two boards. He pinched the underside of the flower and drew out a slender green stem, 6 inches long, like a blade sliding out of a sheath. Moving as carefully as he could, he threaded the stem down into the gap and pushed its tip into the ground below, which accepted it without resistance. Then he stood up and patted the sawdust off his palm with the fingers of the other hand. It happened even faster than he had hoped. The tense green canvas rippled silently around them in a sudden gust of wind, and then a long green shoot sprouted up from the floorboards, winding round one bar of the cage at an impossible time-lapse speed. A second followed, then a third. The air was full of a faint slithering noise like rope uncoiling. He turned to see dozens of them, inquisitive tendrils snaking and grabbing upwards, squirming their way round cage bars and stilts of the ringmaster's chair. Gamzee was looking down at himself, painted face comically astonished. Two thick tentacles had seized him, one wrapping round each leg and holding it in place, before branching into smaller shoots and crawling their way up his chest. As Salix watched, a single loop flickered out like a tongue and latched on to the clown's arm. He turned back. The cage now looked like a trellis in some fancy garden. It was so thickly festooned with foliage you could hardly see the metal, although the basic barred structure was still clear. Neat black buds jutted from among the leaves in a few places, and one burst with an audible pop into a new flower. Almost, he knew, a perfect replica of the one he'd planted, and yet not quite. None of them would be quite the same. There was a hollow metallic clunk and some rustling as the door sprang open, and Rose pushed it clear, tearing aside stalks and clumps of leaves. She stepped out. "We need to move," he said. "Like, now." She didn't ask stupid questions, just waved a hand. Salix caught one last glimpse of Scratch, pinned to his chair by a dozen writhing green cords, a first black flower just blossoming at his lapel. Then the tent and the clown and Scratch were gone, and the vast shining web of the Imperial Network swept out and sharpened all around them like a cloud of silver filament. He looked down. Sure enough, the data artery directly beneath them, a perfectly smooth trunk line of untroubled sky-blue light, was being invaded. Threads of brighter green were sprouting from its surface, winding and coiling along its length. A dark spiky mass erupted from a point where two threads crossed, a kind of stellated geometric outburst of black light, like a tumor made out of crystal. "My God," said Rose. He glanced at her. She was staring down at the twining tendrils, too. He had a moment's stupid panic that she was about to bust out with, "What have you done?" But she just said, "It's beautiful." And he nearly sighed out loud in relief. "I call it the Black Rose Virus," he said. "It's a fucker." "Yes, I can see that." She looked up and met his eyes. "The code is exquisite. I'd need to spend hours parsing it. How on earth did you find the time?" "I was working on a version of it in the villa," he admitted. "But it was meant to be a lot cleverer. See, they wanted me to unlock the air, but no one could tell me a fucking thing about what the lock looked like. I couldn't make a key for a lock I'd never seen, so I decided to make a program that unlocked everything," she finished, and smiled, "on the principle that doors can be kicked down, too." "Yeah, pretty much. It's a universal solvent. If it finds a lock, it pops it and moves on to the next one. Randomized iteration means it's almost impossible for autonomics to think around." He scratched his head on instinct, though nothing itched in the medium. "Problem was delivery. I was going to hook it up to a smart payload and upload the fucking thing remotely from a safe distance, but then everything went to shit. I ended up having to finish it in 2 nights in a shitty skep cell, with the shakes and a permanent nosebleed, and Terezi trying to feed me some kind of fucking awful curry. Couldn't spare an extra day for the delivery package." "So you turned yourself into a Trojan horse?" He shrugged. "Only way. Use my own consciousness as the viral agent. That meant all I had to do was get my mind past their security grid. An infected rig would have got kicked off the network in a second, but an infected user? They don't scan for that shit." Rose was looking at him with an expression he could not place yet. It was weird to know her voice so well, and yet to still be working out her face. I assume you somehow failed to tell Terezi that this would undoubtedly kill you.
Yeah. He forced himself to hold her gaze. Kinda forgot to mention the whole suicide run angle. Thought she might not be too keen. She'll figure it out later.
Mr. Captor, she said, and this time she definitely sounded amused, we will make a seer of you yet. They both turned their heads to stare out across the network, watching the green viral trace coil greedily outward along 100 slender data fibers. After a few seconds, she said, come on.
Come on. Rose, I'm done.
He spread his hands helplessly.
Stick a 2x3 dent in me. That was the play. I just blew open every security protocol in the Imperial Palace simultaneously and signed your name across the whole fucking system. The air's free. Terezi can grab the core and ride off into the sunrise, and I bet in a week or so they'll be saying, long live Emperor Steffery, and I did my fucking job. Now, I just kind of fade on out of here.
I know, you were very brave, Rose said, to turn down his offer.
You think I was tempted? He asked, trying to make it sound offhand.
I know you were tempted. How could you not be? He was giving you what you've always wanted.
Having a body's okay, he said unconvincingly. There's, you know, food and stuff. There's coffee.
She paused and said, Salix, when you were 8 sweeps old, you hacked the drone manifest and took your name off the harvest because it was easier than having sex.
He couldn't blush in cyberspace. He glared at her and opened his mouth to snarl, but when she met his eyes, she just looked sad. Of course she knew, of course. He was a fucking idiot. She'd been in his head for weeks without him even noticing. But all the same, to hear spoken a thing his own mouth had never formed.
I loved you from the moment I found out, she said.
The death of the Imperial Network made no noise. All around him, ice walls were crumbling and sliding like snow off a slammed door. Black glass roses were erupting from the smooth, pale skin of Datacores. Security frames were blowing away like ash in a wind he couldn't feel, and the silence was deep and complete.
Why?
Because, she said, I would have done the same thing once. And she reached out and took his hand in hers. And I wish I could give you what he was offering. I wish I could set you free. But there's no rest for the wicked, and we're not done yet.
The air's free, he repeated helplessly. He'd been fixated for so long on that one phrase, free the air, free the air, free the air and the good guys win. He should have known, really, that the future of the Alternian Empire wasn't going to be settled on a single round of capture the flag. But he'd always preferred working with one clear objective in mind. Hack this, scoop that, steal the other. He hated side quests. You played the game to win. The urge to sleep was overpowering, even here.
Terezi's in danger, she countered.
He stared at her. What?
My idiot Moirel, she said, has bonded consciousness with your idiot Moirel, thus creating a vast, swirling singularity of idiocy on which no man can look and remain unchanged. I am afraid she is going to die. Dave will not leave her. Dave is...
And her face changed minutely. Not very good at leaving people, even when ordered to. The network's crystal veins seemed to be falling away around him. He gripped Rose's hands tight, so that a cool tingle of haptic feedback ran straight to whatever was left of his brain and said, Where?
Follow me, she said, and waved her free arm. The web of data pulsed and swam, and he thought for a second he tasted blood and knew it must be his. They were standing in a bare gray corridor devoid of any interest or even any discernible texture. Bottom-tier virtuality, the kind of utility space you build where no user was ever going to wander. It was the network equivalent of a maintenance duct, a way to give your techs quick, straightforward access to the guts of your system. Hitting one of these meant you were home free. No one ever bothered installing security this deep, which meant if you could find your way in, you had free run of the network, no questions asked. There was no trace of evolving foliage or budding shoots, which made sense. He'd told the Black Rose to target Lux, and there was nothing to lock down here.
There was a door at the far end of the corridor, perhaps 30 feet away. Between them and the door stood Gamzee Macara. He held a brightly colored juggling club loose in each hand, and he wasn't smiling anymore. Selix clenched his fists. "Quite some motherfucking stunt you pulled, boy," said the clown. "Quite some stunt in motherfucking deed." "Yep," Selix said, and grinned maniacally. "Guess it must have been a miracle, huh?" "Whoa now." Gamzee patted one club meditatively against the side of his leg. "Don't be all up and throwing that magic word around, little fight. If you go on taking some straight-up motherfucking blasphemy, some bitch-ass heretical shit, and painting it out as like to the word of the messiahs." He grinned, too, slower and sleepier, and, Selix suspected, 5 times more intimidating than his attempt had been. A brother can't be too fairly found wanting for getting a little anger on, you know? "You sad clown fuck," said Selix, taking a step forward. "This is just pathetic. Up in this and all getting that and whoop whoop. I'm sick of your shit. I'm sick of your stupid cult. I'm sick of looking at that fucking ridiculous face paint. I am having a spectacularly bad day, and I am going to rip your bulge clean off and shove it up your ass. And if I ever meet your fucking messiahs, I'm going to set them both on fire and piss it out." He paused. "Is that enough blasphemy? I've got more." Gamzee chuckled. "Little captor. Little mustard grub. You really do think you're packing globes all up and motherfucking sufficient to clean this righteous clock? I was cutting ice with my holy hatches before you squirmed up out of the caves, brat. I was the best hacker in the motherfucking world." "Was," said Selix, and reached up to tug his glasses clear of his face. For a moment, Gamzee stood outlined in a perfect nimbus of purple light, as though he'd gained the ability to fluoresce. Then he started to fall apart. Selix didn't realize what was happening at first. A sudden fuzziness at the edges, and then the clown was actually dissolving, gray pixels and slivers of matter flaking and crumbling away. He raised one arm, still holding the club, but slowly. He stared at it with an expression of wide-eyed wonder, as larger and larger slices of whatever he was made of peeled up from his arm and streamed away like powder, leaving only gaps behind. "Well, motherfucker," said Gamzee Macara, in tones of childlike astonishment, and disintegrated. Selix swallowed hard. Then he looked round. Rose was standing to his right and a little behind him, holding what had looked like a slim black needle in one hand, its tip pointing at the empty space which had, until very recently, been occupied. "We really don't have time, I'm afraid," she said, and slotted the needle into the sash of her dress. "Let's keep moving." "You killed him." She walked ahead of him down the corridor, towards the door. "Thou shalt not kill, but needs not strive officiously to keep alive. I erased him, Selix." She looked round. "He died a long time ago. He was a data ghost, nothing more. You played fetus spawn, didn't you? Dark is very strong against ghost. Come on." "I can't believe you spent a week in my head learning the rules to fucking fetus spawn," he muttered, and followed her. The room on the other side of the door was another blank space, a tall cylinder, flat gray sides rising to a flat gray roof a long way above. A boy was kneeling in the center of the floor, wearing just jeans, barefoot and bare-chested, with his arms spread wide and his hands higher than his head. He didn't have much choice in the matter, since both wrists were in thick metal cuffs from which equally thick chains ran nearly taut to rings set on opposite sides of the chamber. He might have been 9 sweeps old, and looked like the same species as Rose. No horns, something alike in the bones of the face, although his was leaner and sharper than hers. But he was made of light, warm orange light that rippled here and there like water. Even the narrow triangular lenses of the shades he wore seemed to be made of the same stuff. He looked up as they came in and said, "Hey, Mom." "Hello, Dirk," said Rose. "This is Selix Captor." "Yeah, I know." "Selix?" She made an oddly formal little gesture towards the boy on the chains, as though she could possibly be talking about anyone else. "This is Dirk Strider." "Strider?" he said dumbly. Then, Oh, fuck. You're them, aren't you? You're the Master AI.
Hell fucking yes, said Dirk Strider. I am personally every single katana-toting metal douchebag in the Alternian Empire. You're going to ask me how I keep track of that many isolate perception clusters without going insane, and I'm going to tell you they wrote my code so I'm incapable of going insane, and you're going to be impressed and offer me a rock-solid fist bump, but I'll regretfully have to turn you down. He flexed one arm a little, so the chain clinked. Pleased to meet you, though.
I don't get it, said Selix. The virus should have taken those things off you. I built it to break everything.
Okay, I'll be honest, that was actually fucking sweet, said Dirk. If robo-boners were a thing, I would have completely popped mad robo-boners over the code on that pause. But these chains are 100% scratch-made, and they don't break so easy.
The Prince AI, said Rose, controls the Striders. The Striders control the Empire.
L'état, c'est fucking moi, Dirk put in helpfully.
I thought the heir was the key to the succession, said Selix.
He was. He still is, in fact, in all legitimate senses of the term. But the point of the prince, unlike the heir, is not to protect the throne, it is to protect the Condess herself. The Striders are her personal guard.
If you guys want Condi off the big chair, said Dirk, you need the Striders out of commission. You couldn't take us with an army, trust me. You need me dead.
He said the last part very conversationally. Selix looked at him.
Bullshit. We need you out of these fucking chains, right? Give me 2 minutes.
Dude, no offense, said Dirk Riley. I have mad respect for your skills, but I ain't down with the kinky shit, and I've been trying to safe word out of these babies for like 400 sweeps. You're not doing it in 2 minutes.
And we don't have 2 minutes anyway, added Rose. Dirk, can you bring Selix up to date on the situation? I couldn't risk drawing attention to us out there.
Sure, said Dirk. One sec. And the curved wall behind him shimmered and gave them a crystal-clear, high-definition picture of Terezi.
Selix swore. She was hurt. How badly he couldn't tell, but her face was splattered with teal, and she was using her sword one-handed. As he watched, she ducked under a Strider's blade and drove upwards, wrenching a splash of sparks from its shoulder joint. It staggered but kept coming, forcing her back a couple steps. Behind her were other Striders, but they didn't seem to be focused on her, being occupied with...
Holy fucking shit, he said. Is that Riska?
I'm getting my ass kicked, said Dirk approvingly. There is some straight-up Berserk Charlie's Angels shit going down in that room. Only problem is there's 3 of them, and I just called up another 12 of me.
For fuck's sake! Selix nearly shouted, eyes fixed on the screen as Terezi danced away from another cut. Was her nose broken?
Just fucking stop! Stop fighting them! Turn off or go into power save or something!
Does not compute, dude.
The AI's voice was still infuriatingly calm. Not in the program. You really think if I had any kind of autonomous control here, I'd be going around murdering kids all the time? Shit, I'd be trying to break records for the galaxy's biggest simultaneous Macarena. The chains aren't just fucking symbolic, you know. Oh, damn, nice move.
Rose had stepped closer to him and was gazing at him with a strange, closed-off expression Selix was beginning to decipher.
You're sure there's no other way?
Rose, me and the lab skeleton over there could tag-team these fucking protocols all night long with our massive engorged brains, pausing occasionally to high-five and rehydrate, and I'd still be strung up and doe-eyed like bad dubcon come morning. And by that point, Dylan, Alex, and Natalie are gonna be sashimi.
On the screen, Terezi jammed her sword through the Strider's eye lens so hard Selix saw the tip punch out the back of its smooth metal head. But that trapped the blade, and another one was moving in behind her.
Just do it fast, okay? I don't want to kill anybody else. It kinda got old.
Selix didn't know where to look. At Rose, her violet eyes blank and calm. At Dirk, his translucent orange skin shifting across the jut of his shoulder blades like oil. At Terezi, small and bloody and determined and slowing down even as he watched. The Strider swing would have snipped her head from her shoulders like a cut flower. She twisted clear and got her sword free, tried for a stance. Rose stepped in and cupped her palm against Dirk's jaw. He saw her fingers glow like she was covering a flashlight. She bent, and kissed him gently on the forehead, and her eyes flickered closed for a moment. Then she stepped back and away, and he saw the needle in her other hand. A black dot had formed in the center of Dirk's chest. As Salix watched, a thin thread of darkness spidered out from it, like a crack running down a wall. Then another. "Ah," said Dirk, and stretched. The chains rattled as he rolled first one shoulder, then the other, the exaggerated, luxurious stretch of a day's work finished. Inky trails were diffusing into the massive liquid orange light. One flickered along an arm. He grinned. "Time to fly up away to the sun like a fucknik piece of garbage." He shattered. It made no noise, but one moment there was a kneeling figure in shades, the next a thousand shards of orange glass, expanding almost dreamily in space. The chains, instead of falling, vanished. The light blinked out and was gone. Salix looked at the screen. Teresi was standing, her ribs and shoulders rising and falling under the bloodstained coat, sword still in guard, casting furious glances from side to side as though she were trying to work out the trick. A little way away, Vriska reached up and scratched her head in a weird, uncharacteristic gesture. She was a mess, too, but she turned and said something to Teresi with an expression of honest puzzlement that was somehow rendered bizarrely funny by the blood and the gleaming robot eye. Kanaya stepped into shot, one hand soaked green and clutched against her side, the other hand holding, without apparent strain, a running chainsaw. The strider stood around and among them, still and slack. Their eyes were no longer lit. Vriska reached out and pushed one in the chest. It toppled over backwards. He looked back at Rose, who was standing with her needle still in her hand. "Hey," he said. "You okay?" She raised her head and gave him a little smile. "I am an artificial intelligence, Mr. Captor. Your question is irrelevant." "Well, I'm a puny meat sack," he said. "I get to ask irrelevant questions. Class perk." She sighed. What happened to Salix Captor, age 6, who thought emotion was a sign of weakness? "I'm starting to think he was a fucking idiot," said Salix. She said. "If it's any consolation, Rose Lalonde, age 13, was a disaster. But we learn by doing, I suppose. Are you still planning to die? Or would you like to go for a coffee?"